live and awake at Double Crossed Radio. Hi there, everybody. I'm Chuck Horton with another Thursday night broadcast from Freedom Central. And I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Drew Lamb. Drew, how are you doing?
Doing good, Chuck. Good to hear
Always
your voice this week.
Always good to hear your voice.
Yes.
It's just knowing there's some more sanity out there in the world is comforting to me.
Is this sanity?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people would look at us as slightly wackoed, but you know what? The stuff we were saying 3 years ago is suddenly becoming on a lot of people's lips these days. They're starting to slowly waken to the truth, although I think they're so far – they're going – making such slow progress. I just can't wait for them to figure this stuff out for themselves. So I don't know what's going to happen to them, but they may be way too late by the time they figure out what's going on.
Yeah, if they haven't already, they might not. And yeah, it's a long time coming for most people.
Well, you know, and we're going to get into our show here in just a second, but I think 9/11 is probably a good example. When I talk with people, I either get people who kind of understand that things don't make sense, they don't add up, or you get people that say, no, it couldn't have been a other than what they said, because someone would have come forward and spoken up, you know?
Yeah.
So to them, that seems like a real sensible position, that and nobody would be silent on this issue if it was like you say it is. Mm-hmm. And these people are willing to just, they think that's sensible, it's rational, but they don't think it's irrational at all to suspend their belief in physics and natural sciences, which we know are natural laws that can't be changed. Gravity exists, period. And they don't seem to question anything that the official report does or says that is not explained by the natural laws of physics. Mm-hmm. And they think that that's perfectly okay. So I don't know. There's a lot of people out there that just are their cognitive dissonance or their whatever it is, their normalcy bias is keeping them from the truth.
Yeah, or it could be the football game, the basketball game, the latest sitcom. You know, there's a lot of other things that people would rather think about.
Who's going to win The Voice?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that those things are all bad, but I mean, they should be on the periphery of your life, not in the center.
Right. Not the primary focus of your life.
Yeah.
Sure. Everybody needs some downtime, but that seems to be everything.
Yeah, so last
to a
week
lot of people.
We had a show all about the – it was kind of about mining, and we wanted to kind of cover a little bit more of the sugar pine mine. We got into stuff with Miner Dave, and that was interesting too. But we had a few things we didn't get to cover. We want to make sure we go over them tonight, and so I thought we'd cover those first. The one thing I don't want anybody to get the mistaken impression on this is this isn't the Bundy Ranch. I'm having trouble with my mouth tonight. Mm-hmm. This isn't like a Bundy Ranch standoff. This is completely different. This is the miners. They just want to have their day in court. They believe that they are right and the BLM is wrong, and that a court made up of juries, members of their community, their own peers, being judged by their peers, will decide in their favor, and they think that that's the way it should go. I think the BLM probably knows that too, and that's why they want to just they gave them a cease and desist and remove all your equipment, or we're going to come and melt it down for scrap and burn your cabins. And so the Oath Keepers have kind of stepped in between and said, no, you're not. This is going to go through the constitutional legal process. And the BLM has backed down, and they said, well, we could do that. At least that's what they said. And so for now, it's kind of cooled off a little bit. But this is really a serious issue. If we don't stand up for our constitutional rights, if we don't stand up for other people's constitutional rights, there won't be any when it comes time for us to stand up for ours. So I want all of you to kind of let that sink into your heads a little bit, how important these issues are. And I just love the Oath Keepers for their cool heads and their rational thinking and their passion for individual freedoms.
Well, yeah, absolutely, you know, and that's what Oath Keepers is there for. I think at this point, however, it'd be extremely foolish for BLM to do anything. You know, a lot of attention has been brought to this, and you know, like we talked about last week, you know, there's a lot of concern that somebody from BLM will just go up there and burn down the cabin and destroy property and things like that. And you know, if you look at what happened to Miner Dave, that's, you know, a probability. But I think that it's pretty unlikely at this point. Too many people are watching this. It would not
And
look good if
public
they did something
opinion
like that.
is moving towards the miners day by day. It's growing and growing and growing.
But you know, I you know, and given that, you know, I think that the reaction is a little bit extreme. And this is just, you know, coming from somebody who manages property and has security issues from time to time. And also, you know, I had my dealings with the DSL and my family's property years ago. I've talked about this on the show several times, and how an inspector came from the Oregon Department of State Lands, and they were going to declare, you know, almost half of my family's property a wetland. You know, and I had to deal with them, and I had to meet them on the site, and this guy showed up, and neighbors were upset, and people were ready to start shooting, and I stood there without any weapons, and I used my brain, and I talked to this guy, and I used, you know, proof, I used evidence, I used pictures, I used maps, I did all sorts of things, and you know, and I was able to work something out that saved a big chunk of our property, and you know, kept the government from stealing a big pile of our land from us. And you know, and I didn't need the Oath Keepers, and I didn't need an armed militia, and I didn't need a bunch of hotheads. It was really just going to make things worse for me. And I was able to deal with this with the assistance of a biologist, and a lot of records that the government maintained. So I think that, you know, I'd say to Oath Keepers that you guys need to be careful about who you associate with, and you need to watch out for people that are quick to jump into a physical armed conflict. That's, you know, not something that you want to get into. You know, if you have to defend yourself, of course, absolutely. But you don't want to goad the government or anybody else into a battle. But there are a lot of guys out there, and a lot of guys in this movement that want a battle. You know, they want it, and I would like to urge people to step back,
Yeah,
you know.
you're just a little bit outgunned.
Well, you know, we've talked about this many times on the show too. We've shown how you know, small groups of people were able to defeat big, powerful armies, and even with this military, it's still possible. I mean, if this military is if the US military is so powerful, how come they're still in Iraq? How come they're still in Pakistan? How come they're still in Afghanistan? You know, they're always going to be there. You
Well,
know,
I think they may be there because they're trying to, someone
well,
is trying to bleed the United States of its resources.
yeah, but they it's a pretty it's obviously an inefficient operation for sure.
Yes.
You know, and
And
so,
they're a bloated governmental bureaucracy,
yeah,
just like
but
and they work about the same as every bloated government bureaucracy. That's
so
true.
I don't believe that a physical battle like that is you know, something that's going to be a lost cause. I'm just saying that it should be avoided if possible. You know, let diplomacy reign supreme, and you've got to win the hearts and minds of the people. You know, whoever has the moral high ground is going to win. And
Exactly.
you know, but there's guys out there that want a fight. You know, that's what they want. They don't have the brains to reason, and they want to pick up a firearm and have a battle, you know, and that's the worst case scenario, you know.
Right.
You know, that's the very last thing that we need to have happen. There's a lot of things that have to happen before that, before it gets there, and that is, you know, the government pulling triggers on the people.
Yeah, and now I'm just going to add something and I forgot already. Man, I think I'm getting way too old to do this. That's okay. I think that was a very good summation of what should be done. I would only add this. I think that if you have to use force to accomplish your goals, and it's and a goal other than defending yourself, you probably have a bad goal. Just, you know, the force, if you have to force people into compliance, either as a, if you're the majority or you're the government, or if you're the people like the miners and you have to use force, if you're initiating force to get your way, you probably don't have a good solid position to stand on to begin with. And I think they kind of realize that because they've been trying to keep people's, you know, cooler heads and whatever. At least that's what I've read. I don't know any of these guys personally, and maybe they're hotheads. I don't know, but it seems to me like maybe someone has talked some sense into them if they were, and they realize that yeah, the public opinion is coming our direction. We don't want to screw it up by doing something stupid.
Right, exactly. That's the point I'm trying to make here.
Yeah.
You know, you've got public opinion on your side. You got to maintain the moral high ground. You
If you
know,
start
and
forcing throwing your weight around, you just become a small-time bully who's met a bigger bully, and who cares what happens to you?
yeah. But you will be judged by who your contemporaries are. You know, so you need to be careful who you associate with. You need to be very careful with that, you know.
Okay, well, I think that's what I wanted to cover tonight. Did you have some more you wanted to add about the mines?
No, I think that these guys will have their day in court. I seriously doubt that the BLM's going to be messing around up there. You know, and so, you know, we'll see what happens, and I hope that they have their day in court, and I hope that they win, and I think that they will. You know, I think that that the miners are right. I think that they're correct, and we've seen BLM and U.S. Forest Service abuse their authority, and we know what their mission is. We know that their mission is to push human populations out of these areas, you know, and herd people into plantopolises, you know, under Agenda 21. And everybody should check out Agenda 21. You could go to the UN's website, and it is there. Just go there, and if you don't have a lot of time, just read the preamble. The preamble will tell you everything that it's about. It's anti-human, it's anti-property, it's pro-collectivism. It is not something that we want to live under, and what we're seeing is a gradual implementation of it.
I agree. Okay, let's move on to the I guess the we're going to bring in some dismal science for everybody this week. And I just to me this was a week of a perfect storm of economic information and writings that were put forth onto the different blogs on the internet. I just was so wow, these are all even though they were talking about different subjects, they all kind of tied together, which I think when you're speaking the truth, that kind of happens more than it doesn't. But the first one was actually one of the last pieces I shared on our Facebook pages. It was about high prices and low prices. And I'm always really intrigued about somebody doing an analysis on prices because to me that that's like I equate prices with the invisible hand. It's the thing that kind of guides our economy and whatever. And so it's really an important thing. It's an important part of our economic outlook, our economic analysis. And I think that, you know, everybody needs to stop and think for a minute, just what is it that make prices go up? I mean, like there's certainly demand can have something to do with it, and certainly supply of a commodity, but there can be other things. And so there's a, we don't like it when prices are higher. We like it better when they're lower. So what things make them go down? Well, again, it's demand and supply. And there can be some other things that can make them go down, like built up malinvestment that creates an oversupply of something that is, you know, money has been invested in wisely in long-term investments, and suddenly there's no there's no market for them, and so they have to be liquidated at just at, you know, prices which signify huge losses for the entrepreneurs that invested in them. That can happen, and that's not just deflation. That's collapse. So those there's prices are they signal us things that are happening when they can signal a they can give us a false signal because we don't have a free market in money anymore. So prices can oftentimes give us the wrong signal. It can tell us the wrong picture. By the way, those of you out there, and I'll have Drew answer for all of you. In terms of whether prices are higher or lower, which one do you prefer, Drew?
Well, I prefer lower prices when I'm buying, and I prefer higher prices when I'm selling.
There you go. I think that's a perfectly reasonable, rational answer. That's exactly how I feel. I think almost everybody out there does. And if you don't, you're an idiot. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to insult you if you didn't. If you disagreed with this. If you have a rational reason, we would entertain that. You're free to call in.
That sounded selfish, but well, that's really how I feel deep down in my heart.
I think everybody acts in self-interest. I don't think people act for other people's benefit 100% of the time. You may, for a short period of time, do that out of because you have the resources to do it and feel that it's a worthy thing to do. But there aren't very many Mother Teresa's out there.
Well, as Ludwig von Mises pointed out, economics is human action.
True. So another question that I always think about is when a broad group of prices, just about everything in our economy, the prices go up, who suffers the most when that happens? Well, it would be the people with the least amount of money.
Sure, of course.
They're wiped out. I mean, they may go from food being 25% of their budget to being 75% of their budget. Mm-hmm. So they start living out of their car in a van down by the river.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, well, does anybody really profit from rising prices? And I says, yeah, it's pretty easy to if you're sure it's going to happen. You can leverage yourself and, go into debt and pay back the debt with cheaper money. And you can make a lot of money that way. Mm-hmm. You can, own real estate, a hard commodity, with money that's worthless. You paid off the loan with worthless money, basically, or money that has much less value than the money you originally started your loan with. So, you can play that game if you're a gambler. It doesn't always just keep going up, though. Sometimes it collapses, like I said, and we have a collapse like that, that bubble bursts. It pretty much takes a lot of people to the cleaners.
The upside, the upside with inflation is that it also devalues debt. You know, so if you do. If you do own real estate and you've got a mortgage on that real estate, you know, that debt becomes, a lower portion of your income moving forward, as long as you don't refinance or something like that. But as inflation starts pulling up the cost of everything else, and hopefully it's pulled up it's pulled up your income, but that's not always the case. That debt that you owe becomes a smaller and smaller portion, you know, as long as you haven't increased the amount of it, you know, and I suspect that that's one of the reasons why the banksters pump more money into the economy. You know, these guys are leveraged, and so they could evaporate some of that debt, you know, make it so it's worth less and less and less. The U.S. government's clearly doing that.
Yeah, and Simon Black had an article this week, which we shared. It was pointing out how illiquid the Federal Reserve is, and it's not really. They still have a net worth of over $1 trillion. I'm trying to find the exact figure here, but anyway, that even though it is that much, that is that amount is only 1.3% of its total assets. So, as and this is quoting Simon Black, he says that's a laughably thin margin of safety. It wouldn't take much of anything. Like if interest rates went up by 2%, went from 0 to 2%. I mean, 2% prime rates are still relatively low in the course of human history. That would wipe out the Federal Reserve. They would be bankrupt. Period. And the only thing they could do to solve that is to print more money, which I think they probably would. Because they can, they have a monopoly over the creation of money, and it's legal tender. And it's not really money; it's currency. I keep calling it money. Stop me when I do, Drew. It's currency. It's not money. Real money is backed by hard asset commodities like gold, silver, things like that.
Yeah, or they have value due to their utility.
Yes, like Bitcoin.
Sure.
So anyway, in talking about the role of prices in our society, and I've talked about this before on the show, and I think it's important to keep bringing this up. Prices, and this is kind of my own idea here, prices are really the invisible hand that shapes the market. Prices are that it's like a coded message that goes to entrepreneurs and consumers. And it's telling the entrepreneurs when it's time to produce something because there's prices starting to rise on a certain product. And they say, oh, people like that. They want more of it. We'll produce more. We'll bid for more resources to make this product. And the consumers, when they see prices going up, they say, oh, maybe this is getting to be kind of scarce. Maybe we need to ration out. We don't want to spend all of our money on this just because prices are going up. Maybe we'll ease off a little bit. So it tells us when things need – when supply is forcing prices up, it tells us when we need to conserve. Oftentimes in the wake of a disaster like Hurricane Sandy, I think this is when I wrote this piece, governors will step right out and say, we don't want to have any price gouging. We're going to freeze the prices where they are. Anybody that's caught price gouging is going to go to jail. Well, so the shelves in the grocery stores are immediately just empty. There's nothing for anybody because they didn't let the market set the price. They tried to fiddle with it. Well, the same thing happens when you print too much money. It debases the money. The price signals that guide people's behavior are just so distorted they make really bad decisions.
There's also some other elements caused by the government that cause distortion, and we see that all the time, like property taxes, for example. You know, those will drive the cost of holding property, which affect the rate of rent that a business will pay, and then there are other things too, like minimum wage, employment taxes,
laws.
Things like that, that add to the cost of doing business, and so the businesses try to recover that cost by packing it into the price of their product or their service, but that doesn't mean that the demand is there to cover that. So
they still distorted that price signal.
Exactly. Yeah. So of course the business wants to try to recover that. They want to try to maintain their margin, but a lot of times they can't. I see this all of the time, and they can't. So their margin just got smaller. It's really odd how the government just assumes that the market can absorb their inefficiency. You know, and you take property taxes. Property taxes are a really big chunk of the cost to businesses that own or lease property. You know, they're going to pay for it one way or the other. They're either going to pay for it through a triple net lease, or the landlord's going to price it into the rent, and they're going to pay for it. And the consumer is going to pay for it. But the consumer can make a choice. They can say, well, you know, I'm not going to buy this good or service because it's just not worth it for me to pay that much for it, or I can't afford to.
Yeah, they have so many available resources, they have to choose which things they're going to purchase with it.
Right. So it's completely destructive for the government to be affecting the economy like that.
Yeah. So with regards to our currency, when the currency is debased, and I believe with every ounce of my soul that it has been severely debased, why do we subject ourselves to a central bank that has monopoly control over the creation of our currency, and we're left with these problems that they create? And if you don't believe me, I got some stuff here to tell you about this. And Drew can weigh in on this too, because I know he knows a lot about this as well. In the 19th century, it was the kind of the birth of the Industrial Revolution, and it made huge changes in people's lives. And what happened was that the advances in productivity lowered the cost of just about everything that anybody would ever want to purchase, so that things that were only available to the very rich, the top 0.1% possibly, were now something that anybody could afford. And so even though people didn't maybe make a whole bunch more than they did before, although they generally, because they became more productive with the use of machines, they made more money, but they also, the prices of almost everything that they would want were falling over the 100 years of that century. And while all that was happening, they had pretty close to zero inflation for 100 years. I'll say that one. They had pretty close to zero inflation, 0% inflation over a 100-year period.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's very incredible. Then, in the 20th century, starting that increase in wages that were happening every decade during the 19th century, it continued, but it began to slow starting in 1914 and eventually stopped expanding in the 1970s. And for those, I think a lot of our listeners probably understand the significance of the date 1914. I know that it wasn't the year I was born. 1914 was the year the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, but it didn't begin operations until 1914. So that was the year it began to control the currency supply. And 1971 was the year that Nixon took us off the gold standard, which basically took the governor off the engine and let it go wild. And they used inflation to pay for the war in Vietnam, which was then, that payment was then put onto the backs of the working people in this country, who were able to buy less with their labor than they were able to buy before. And all in all, from 1914 to 2014, the cumulative inflation in the United States was 2,236%. Compared to the 100 years of the 19th century, 0%. And that's what the Federal Reserve has done to our money. So maybe you should be getting an idea here why prices in general don't go down all the time like they did in the 19th century. Well, they don't go down anymore. We've had over 2,000% increase. We've had tremendous innovation in the 20th century. I mean, we've gone from horse-drawn carriages to walking on the moon in one century. We should have, things should be dirt cheap, the productivity increases we've had.
Well, and
Everybody
there
should
are
be
a lot of
encouraged.
things. There are a lot. Sorry to interrupt. There are a lot of things that have stayed the same in price or have gone down in the price, but that is due to the exploitation of certain people. Like Chinese slave laborers, for example.
Yes.
And so I wouldn't necessarily call that a free market effect, except for a company just, like Apple, goes, well, we're gonna look around the world and find the cheapest place to make our product. It's cheaper to have it made, there. Some things I noticed. I bought a portable air compressor a few months ago, and it was one of those that plug into your cigarette lighter in your car so you could pump up a tire or something like that. And I'd had the same one since about 1989. I'd had the exact same one. It was a gift, and I used the heck out of it, and it was still good, except when Roxy was a puppy, she chewed through the cord. Anyway, it was worth about $20. in 1988. So I was trying to find another one, and I was over at Home Depot, and I happened to see a stack of these, and they were identical. They were identical to the one that I got in 1988, but they were only $10. And so I said, "Oh, there's got to be a catch." And I purchased it, and I brought it home, and it works. It works just fine. We'll see if I get more than 20 years worth of use out of it or not. But it was, that was something that actually had gone, it'd fallen in price massively, massively fallen in price. And the product was exactly the same. So that was probably due to an exploitation of labor in a certain place. Maybe some things, some production capabilities became more efficient. But and then you've got inflation, that has been quite significant since then. So, back in 1988, I don't know, maybe the price of that would have been $2 or $3, all things being the same. I don't know. So we've seen some things come down,
Yeah,
but not everything for the most part. I mean, you've got this CPI index that is highly manipulated, so that.
and there's a lot of innovation going on despite all this other stuff. I know that in my previous life as in the jewelry business, watches were a great example of this, where they Seiko and Citizen make more than half of the watches sold in the world. Combined, they have over a 50% share of the market. And they have virtually no employees making watches. They're all made by robots. Robots work 24/7. They don't go on strike. They don't need cost of living increases in wages. That's the future, people. But the good part of this is, if you can find something productive to do in your life, watches that are as good as these watches used to cost thousands of dollars. Now they cost a couple hundred dollars. So this is the kind of price reduction we should be seeing. And if it wasn't for the inflation that's going on, they'd be costing even less than that. This is the kind of reduction in prices through innovation we should be seeing. But the Federal Reserve is actually one of the major impediments to innovative growth. Their actions divert capital investment into the kinds of research that would bring apart more of these innovations, and there it diverts it into malinvestment and long-term investments, like it's just things that you normally wouldn't do, except in a really low interest rates, which signify there's a lot of savings being generated. So it's a time for to build more products so we can get people to spend more money. Well, that's not what's really happening. They just artificially lowered the interest rates, so people are building these things and they're making stuff no one really wants, because they can't get the right signals from the currency anymore. It's giving them the wrong price signals. And so the Federal Reserve, through their actions, they've diverted all the investment away from innovation. They've put it into stuff that we don't. They're making stuff we don't want, stuff that we would just soon do without. They're not making as many new products as they could. Plus, there's other factors in there. The government is a major, well, they're like a railroad train, innovation railroad train running with the brakes on. It doesn't happen very fast because of all the barriers they put in the way. And I think the biggest barrier is the patent system, which is supposed to be protecting intellectual property and promoting innovation through that protection, allowing people to profit from their ideas and innovations. But it's working exactly the opposite the way it's intended. And we had a really terrific, if you guys, if there's one thing out of this program you're gonna, I'd really just encourage you to read. It's from the Mises Institute. It was The author was Louis Ronet. I think that's a French name, so I hope I pronounced it right. Ronet, Rouanet. And it was called Michael Chevalier's Case Against the Patent System. This was written in the 19th century. He was a very influential French economist, and he was a fierce free trade person, free market. He thought that tariffs and intellectual properties laws were the actual opposite of free market action. And the reason that he knew this was true is because they required the force of government to put them in place. And while we have friends of our show that think of intellectual property as real property. Now, I don't think so anymore. I used to think the way you do, CBJ. And I understand where your thoughts are coming from, but I've changed my mind. I really think if that was true, you wouldn't require the force of government. People could protect their own property rights that way. They could keep it secret until they're ready to release it. But I think society would have far more innovation. And we've seen that. We had on the guy who wrote the case against intellectual property, Stefan Kinsella. And he talked about how Netherlands had done away with all their intellectual property rights that dealt with pharmaceutical stuff. And they had more pharmaceutical discoveries or new products introduced in 1 year than they had in 10 years. And that was because there is no reason to wait and to file a patent and to try and milk it for as much you can before you release the next one. You had to get your stuff out there on the market before it was obsolete. And so there was more and more and more stuff being produced.
Yeah. Yes.
And society was benefiting as a whole. And so were the people who were the innovators. They were known for what they're able to create. People were investing in them to get them to produce more stuff like this.
It's a race to get to the market.
Yes. And the patent system, if there's one thing they should really abolish in this country, I think it's the patent system. It's I'm going to quote from this. This is the Chevalier. He wrote I'm not going to try and pronounce this. I don't know how to pronounce French words, but it's from this major piece that he wrote, and it says, in absolute terms, patents diminish the productive power of nations that recognize them. Evident proposition for those who believe that freedom, free competition, is the great lever of industrial progress. So what he's saying is that in free markets with free competition, they will just fly past these countries that are protecting intellectual property rights of people because their innovation knows no bounds. It's not being restricted. And they're going to be so far ahead. And that's what drove the United States during the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And we had intellectual property laws there, but they weren't the same ones we have today.
Yeah. But the purpose was to allow small players, small inventors to develop a product and have monetary gain through their research and development, you know, and it worked. But now the patent system as it exists now is for big companies to get monopolies for certain lines of products or to totally dominate certain industries, to stifle competition. And what's happened now is that if you're a patent holder, a lot of these patent holders, their business model is to license by suing. So they just they sue and then they settle by working out a licensing deal. So that's the patent system today. You know,
yeah.
it's they're deals that are being worked out in the federal courts.
And there's not really a
way to run business. You know, it's like you have these federal courts and that's what they're there for. Basically for these corporations to hash out licensing deals with each other is utterly ridiculous. You know, it's not free market. It's socialistic in a sense because you've got the government involved in litigating these things, you know. So there's huge costs to everybody else that don't have anything to do with this thing. So in effect, industries and these companies that operate like this are being subsidized by the taxpayer.
You know, here's something else that happens, and probably the major company that engages in this practice is Microsoft. Microsoft is not an innovative company at all. They purchase other companies' patents. They purchase other companies in order to get a hold of their patents so they can sue the heck out of people. And that's how they raise a lot of their money. And they don't have really innovative products. That's why Apple has always been a thorn in their side, because Apple has been a lot more innovative than they have. But Microsoft made a lot more money because they knew what companies they could go out and buy enough stock to take over the company, and then they could use that the intellectual property that they had to sue people who were in violation of those laws. And they did it over and over and over and over again. And that's the majority of their wealth came from those things, not from anything they discovered or innovated. They just copied Apple most of the time and got away with violating real intellectual property. I have another just real quick example. When you get into a really highly regulated, government-regulated system, like, and I'll use a school as an example, there is very, very, very little innovation or technological progress. And, you know, you don't have to look hard or even use your imagination to see why homeschoolers are able to, you know, be 2 to 3 years ahead of their peer groups in terms of what they've learned, despite not having multi-million-dollar schools to be educated in and all this other stuff. All you need is a computer these days. Mm-hmm. You can learn quite a bit.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, the public schools are really, they're like the Titanic, and they can only go one speed because they have to make it to port at a certain time, or they're not going to make enough money to make their payment on the loan on the ship. And it doesn't matter that they're in an ice field, they have to go full speed ahead. And homeschoolers, they're like a little skiff that just kind of goes around all the icebergs, and they get there without sinking on, you know, ahead of the Titanic anyway. Mm-hmm. Well, that leads us to the next related story, which we posted this week. And this is a story about, this was from Prison Planet. And intellectual property laws are being used to keep people from working on their own cars. And I say, well, Alex Jones, he's kind of famous for making sensational headlines, so I have to read this and see. No, that's really true. That's exactly what's happening. The Association of Global Automakers, a lobbying firm for 12 manufacturers, is asking the U.S. Copyright Office to prevent car owners from accessing computer programs that control functioning of a motorized land vehicle, including personal automobiles, commercial motor vehicles, and agricultural machinery for purposes of lawful diagnosis and repair or aftermarket personalization, modification, or other improvement. This is just outrageous.
But by the way, you can right now buy a code reader device at Harbor Freight for about $50. They've got a bunch of them down there, and you could easily find a 20% off coupon, and it's one of those readers, and you just plug it in to the port, you know, under your dashboard, and you could diagnose problems with your own car. So I think, given this information, I'm going to buy one.
Here's what I think is the real problem for the car makers. They have employed with them, I don't know, maybe dozens, maybe hundreds of really, really smart engineers that are always trying to innovate and improve and do things. But I tell you what, it doesn't matter if they have 100 or 1,000. There are millions of people out there that like to work on their car. And I tell you, out of those millions of people, there's got to be at least 1,000 of them that are smarter than the people the car guys have working for them. They are just mechanical geniuses, and they just do it as a hobby. And the car manufacturers are afraid that they're going to come up with something that's better than what they have, and they're not going to be able to get anything out of their intellectual property because it's going to be obsolete. They don't want any more innovation. They don't want improvement. They want to milk what they've got. And that's, I think, the real thing. So intellectual property is used by the people that own it to keep progress from happening so they can continue to profit over something that really should be obsolete. I mean, that's just my opinion. I don't have any proof, but I think that is plausible, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And finally, the last word And this comes from the Dollar Vigilante blog site. And this was written by the senior analyst, Ed Bugos. And we posted that early in the week. And this is the title of this one is Where Do Precious Metals Go From Here? And it's analysis that Ed Bugos has done. And usually you don't get a chance to read his work unless you're a subscriber to their site. So anytime anything that he writes shows up for free, I always say, well, this is either got to be a little bit older or maybe it isn't that, you know, that heavy of a stuff. So they're trying to tease you into going in a little deeper. But that wasn't the case here. This was pretty involved, and it had a lot of research and had a lot of good reasons why gold and silver are really this is a good time to collect those precious metals, why they are undervalued, why all this currency that's been produced by the Federal Reserve is going to start. And there's all sorts of evidence. There's the BRICS nations are having their summit, and they're starting their own currency, their own trading currency. And there's more and more. There's a group of nations in Europe that are doing something similar to that because they're tired of the being pegged to the inflationary U.S. dollar. And all the other countries are inflating their currency to try and keep trade even. They want to make it fair trade. If they just let the U.S. hang themselves, they'd be much better off. But what's happening is that more and more countries are understanding what's happening, and they've just about had it. And this could be one of the tipping points that sends the whole world into a recession or a collapse, financial collapse, because it isn't just the United States that's inflating its currency. It's almost every nation they trade with, because they're trying to keep their international trade balanced. And that's the most ridiculous concept I've ever heard of in my life. I mean, if I trade $5 with my butcher for a steak, is that an unbalanced trade? What would you say, Drew? So well, I have a trade deficit of $5 or a trade surplus, huh? And I have a deficit because I got something. I didn't give him anything. So I didn't sell him any of my product, but I gave him $5. As long as I can keep printing $5 bills, I can get an endless supply of steaks.
Sure.
Until he gets smart to that. And then all of a sudden my $5 can't buy anything.
It's a good racket. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's what Ed was trying to say, that we're kind of reaching that point. And he's saying that he thinks that gold could go as high as maybe $5,000 an ounce in the near future. And that's about five times what it is now. And silver, he was saying, well over $100.
Well, that would be incredible. You know, we've been waiting for something like this to happen for some,
just about since the show started.
Yeah, I don't know, about 4 years it seems to me that we've been waiting on this, and every now and again a story comes out, you know, that says, you know, such and such country is going to go on the gold standard, or Apple's new watches are going to be so popular that Apple's going to have to buy up half of the gold on the planet, you know, and all these crazy stories that get people excited about the price going up, and then it keeps going down, and you know, and these are spot prices, and you know, possibly, you know, prices are better on the street. I don't know. I haven't tried.
Well,
to
there's a huge premium you pay when you buy gold now because it's hard to get.
Yeah.
So the guys that buy and sell gold, they need to make a little bit more than they used to because they can't always replace it right away.
Yeah,
and they have to pay a premium to get it too.
Yeah, there's the physical market and the paper market. You know, there was a story, I can't remember where it came from, that I read a while back that you know, said that the prices were being held down so that China could acquire more gold. I don't know if that's true. It's been really hard to figure this out. And every time there's a story, you know, that, Ross Rothschilds are getting out of Rothschild banks are getting out of fixing the price of silver. Good, the free market's going to do it. It'll go up, and it went down. So,
It's because a different bank got into it after they did.
So, I don't know. I've started just ignoring these stories, and I just expect the price to keep going down for inexplicable reasons. And I don't know. I don't know if it's going to go up or not, or
Well,
what's going to make it go up. I mean, you would think that, you know, as these central banks continue to print money, that inflation would definitely make gold or silver tantalizing investments, and the prices would go up, you know. But it just isn't happening. We keep seeing it go down, 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 down. You know, and I wonder, you know, if it's because investors look to the stock market, you know, and a lot of the money that's being manufactured by the Fed goes straight into the stock market and keeps going up. And so people who have extra money to invest are betting on that instead of making a more prudent investment in precious metals.
that could be true.
You know, so it's so hard to say what's going on. The real challenge with investing in precious metals is that it is difficult to figure out what its intrinsic value is because it doesn't generate revenue. So that's.
Yeah, the one thing I would say you could kind of use as a guideline is for 100 years in the 19th century, when inflation was zero, a $20 gold piece was an ounce and it was worth $20. So since 1914 to 2014, we've had 2,236% inflation. Gold has gone from $20 an ounce to whatever 20 times that would be. So gold could actually be a lot more than 5,000.
Well, yeah, and you could buy a gallon of gas with a silver dime.
Yeah.
You know, with
So maybe
and so.
some prices are falling due to innovation and productivity. It's just been covered up by the massive inflation from the greedy bankers printing money out of thin air. So if you guys out there still think the Fed is a respectable institution, we're not very good communicators. Anyway, we're getting close to the end of our program. We could go on talking for a little bit, but I think it's been a pretty good program. I was really interested in all the things you had to say, Drew, and it was. I hope all of you guys realize that so far, the only thing we've been wrong about anything that we've predicted on our show is the length of time it would take for the dollar to collapse. We thought it would happen before now, but just about everything we've talked about in the years of since we started this program has come to pass. We've had so many "I told you so's" just this year. It's almost been laughable. I've been saying, "Wow, we talked about that happening, and here it happened." And a lot of the stuff I wish it hadn't happened. I wish we'd have been wrong. So you go ahead and doubt us if you want to, but I think you should go out and do some of your own research and read some of the, you know, find out what some of the facts are before you get too wound up in just going along your merry way. I mean, there's just like I said, 9/11 is a good way to explain this. You can believe that jet fuel can cause all the supporting girders in a building to fail at exactly the same time so that it falls in free fall for over 200 feet. Despite the fact that jet fuel doesn't burn hot enough to melt steel, and it would be just probably the most improbable thing. It'd be like winning 10 lotteries in a row. And you know, for something like this to happen, it's just so improbable that it's on the, you know, on the verge of impossible. And I believe it is impossible. The things that are happening in our world are going to bring about a certain result, and I don't think there's anything that can be done anymore to stop that result from happening. The dollar is going to collapse. I just don't know when. And history is on my side. Every fiat currency that has ever existed has failed. So you can doubt what we say, but I would spend some time reading the facts instead of whistling in the graveyard. So, do you have any closing comments, Drew?
No, I would wholeheartedly agree. You have to be very careful about keeping your money in the bank. If the money's in the bank, it's not your money. It really isn't liquid. People think of cash as being liquid, but if you've got it in the bank, it's not liquid. And we've seen things happen, you know, in Greece, Croatia. Was it Croatia?
Cyprus.
Cyprus, sorry. Croatia. Yeah. I'm getting tired. Cyprus, you know, the depositors were bailed in. Mm-hmm. You know, they had to bail in. And Argentina, you know, we've seen they closed banks. They've done this a couple of times where they've closed the banks. They had a bank holiday, and then they debased their currency. And next business day, you basically have less money than you had before.
Yeah.
It's an invisible tax in a way, you know,
and trying to do away with currency altogether in this country. And then when it's all digital, you are helpless.
Yeah. Pretty.
There's no way you can take some digital money and put it under your mattress for a time when the banks go belly up or they're closed for a while. You're going to have nothing to spend money on,
right?
And
at least even with Bitcoin, which is a digital currency, you could actually print it out, so you don't have to keep it in a digital wallet. And even if you do, you control that wallet. So
yeah.
So you do have much more power there than when you just have a bank statement. So it looks like we're coming up on the end of the show here.
Yeah, we're going to get to listen to the whole music fade out tonight. Well, I hope all you people really get something out of this, and it helps your lives and helps you prepare for the future. That's my closing words. I really don't like to see people they're going to get trounced by what's going to happen, and especially when you have time to do something about it still.
Yeah, and develop some skills, post collapse skills, and learn how to grow your food, and invest in food, and farmland.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion.
Good advice. Well, see you next week, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
To break one more time.